Jared, you're, I see your camera on, Jared. You're going to be my the sound person for me. Thumbs up if you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you.
Can you see me?
I can see the PowerPoint. I can't see your face.
Okay. We will get this, you know, just when we thought we had, like, this hybrid meeting kind of worked out, we went all virtual now. And so we are, Montana and I are in the meeting room is for the Anchor location. So we're just getting the OWL video all connected. So it'll just take a couple of, just take a minute.
Hey, I'm going to turn off my video so you don't have to see my messy office.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, Carolyn.
And I will mute.
Perfect. I'll just turn on my camera. All right. I'll just turn my camera on rather than use the OWL camera if that's helpful, if that will work. We are just waiting for everyone to get here. This meeting is a little bit different in the fact that because we're going to do some breakout rooms during the middle of the meeting, we don't have a separate panelist group from the general public. So everyone's all together. I would ask that those that are participating that are not on the board, just to please keep your microphones muted. And then there will be times when we will ask for public comment or ask for if there's any feedback from the general public. And that would be a time where you could raise your hand, and then you'll have the ability to unmute yourself to speak. But we would just like for the discussion part just to be with the board members until unless designated. Looks like we still have a few. We're missing quite a few board members. So we'll just sit tight here for a second. Is everyone having a good January? It's the 12th of January. It feels like we're already like halfway through and it's almost over, right?
I know taping sucks. Like, I know that. Other times so I went with
we can them. Hear you if you'll mute your microphone.
Sorry. Okay. I thought I was off.
You're fine. Some responses. Some colds going around, some sickness going around. Yes, I did feel, you know, the spike in cases just... did want to bring everyone all together in one room, so thanks everyone for moving to this virtual format. Montana, do we have...
We don't have everyone yet, and I'm just changing my settings.
Do we have a quorum?
Yeah. Not quite yet. Let me
okay.
Get back to...
We'll go ahead and get started. Montana, you, everyone, I am Rebecca Banner. I am the director of the Office of Child Care. Our chair, Rhonda, is unable to be here today, so she has asked me to chair this meeting today. So I will do so on her behalf. Montana, will you do a roll call and let us know who's here?
Yeah, so just looking through the participants here. Let's see. I can see Crystal Nippers, Johnny Anderson. Jared Lisenby,
Ollie told me she was trying to get on, just FYI.
Okay.
Okay.
We've admitted them. I think they're trying to get Jody Zabriskie.
Is that it?
Yes, we still don't have...
We don't have a quorum.
Correct.
Okay.
Katie.
We will do... if we don't have... We'll go ahead and continue going. If we don't have a quorum, then I will hold on voting on the November 10th meeting minutes. And we can do that later in the meeting when we have a quorum. The first thing that we have on our agenda item is we have a training on the Open Public Meetings Act. This is a training that is required of boards periodically, and it had been a little bit since this board had received that training. And so I've asked Elliot Lawrence, who is an attorney with the Department of Workforce Services, to provide this training for us. And so, Elliot, if you do the training as you get unmuted and I see your camera on. Just to let the board members know, there was a handout that was emailed to you earlier this morning for this agenda item. So if you don't have that, check your inbox for that. And then, Elliot, we'll turn the time over to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And we have the PowerPoint. Montana is supposed to... use your PowerPoint?
Yes.
Okay. We're training for open and public meetings. And like I said, I've prepared a handout that was sent out to you. So if you wish to follow along, the handout has a little more detail than we have in the slides and has the citations to the laws. So we go to the next screen. Okay, the Open Public Meetings Act is found at Title 52, Chapter 4 of the Utah Code, and the public policy of the state is, if you click the button, it should work. Public agencies like this committee exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business, and therefore the meetings and the deliberations of public agencies are to be conducted openly, and any actions taken are to be done open. Montana, if you could click. Open deliberations and take actions openly. That is the gist of the Open and Public Meetings Act, so that the public has the assurance that the public business is being done in the open, and if the public wishes to participate or even to observe, they can do so. Okay, so let's have the next screen. Okay, so they say that there's the old saying, the devil is in the details. When it comes to statutes, the devil is in the definitions. So let's click first is maybe the most important, the definition of a meeting. It is the convening of a public body with a quorum present, including a workshop or executive meeting, to receive comments, to act on any matter that is within the jurisdiction of the public body. So, for example, this meeting, this has been convened, and it is to receive comments and act on matters that are within the jurisdiction of the Office of Child Care, the advisory committee. If you'll notice on the PowerPoint, I put that it does not include a chance meeting or a social gathering. So if you all just happen to bump into each other at the shopping mall, you're not in violation of this act. However, the act does... While it allows a social gathering, it explicitly says that you cannot use a social gathering or a chance meeting as a way of getting around the act. So if you all decide to have a Super Bowl party and you all meet at someone's house to watch the Super Bowl, that's all you should do is watch the Super Bowl. You can't use that as an excuse to talk about, well, let's talk about something that's coming before this committee. Also, and we will touch on this a little more, the meeting may be conducted electronically. Obviously, we're doing so now. So, one more click. convening, calling together by an authorized person. So that would be our staff, or however it's determined as a member of the public body. I can't, for example, call this committee together. I do not have authority to do so. All right, let's have the next slide. And one more click, a public body. Any administrative body that is created by statute that has at least two members, expends public revenue or is supported by public revenue and makes decisions regarding public business. So let's see, what about this committee? Let's click and see what happens. Cross our fingers and hope it happens anyway. There it goes. Okay, that's you guys. There is created a child care committee. This is the state statute section of the statute that creates this committee. So you are created by a statute or rule. I believe you have more than two members. If my arithmetic is correct, I think it's at least 17. And then this states your general purpose, your general powers, reviewing recommendations in the annual budget, providing recommendations on how to best respond to child care needs, and recommending use of money. So you are, therefore, a public body within the definition of the Open Public Meetings Act. And we do have a couple more definitions, Montana. Okay, participate means the ability to communicate with all members. And I include that because there have been, not you guys, of course, there have been some stories of a public meeting, a public board, where members of the board were sending text messages to each other. So if one of you sends a text message to another member of the body, are you participating? So no, because you have to be able to communicate with all members. And we do have a question here. The open meetings requirement by the subcommittees. Yes. Yes, it would include subcommittees because that would, again, fall under the provision of a public body. And a quorum, we've got, already heard Rebecca mention, a quorum is a majority of the members. In fact, in your statute, the 35A, that same section does specifically state that a quorum is a majority of the members of the committee. Okay, let's move on to the next screen. Okay, this is pretty much the essentials of the Utah Public Open and Public Meeting Act. All meetings of public bodies are open to the public. It's that simple. There are some exceptions. A meeting, Montana, can click. Meetings may be closed. There are circumstances where a meeting may be closed. And also, and this is kind of a special exception, if you are sitting as a quasi-judicial body, in other words, like hearing an appeal, which I don't believe you do, they can be exempt from the act and may be conducted in a closed session, but any decisions that arise from that have to be announced in a public meeting. So that's the essentials of the act. If you're a public body, you meet in public. Okay, move on. Okay, before a meeting notice of a meeting must be at least 24 hours in advance. The notice must include the date and the time and the place of the meeting, and also a meeting agenda. And it is posted in writing, generally at the principal office of the public body, the headquarters, as it were, and also at the Utah Public Notice website, and is provided to a newspaper or a media correspondent. Notice it doesn't have to be published in the newspaper. It just needs to be provided. And most public agencies they schedule their meetings a year in advance. You have meetings. Usually it's a notice to the newspaper of the schedule of the annual meetings is sufficient to provide that satisfy that. But posting a written notice at the principal office and also the public notice website is to give notice. So move on to the next screen. And this is what the public notice website looks like. And this is actually, it's a screenshot for today's meeting. And you can see that it's the name of your committee. And there at the bottom, it has the start of the date and time, January, today, 1 p.m. So that is a portion of the screenshot for your meeting, just to give you an idea of what the public notice website looks like. It would include the agenda, would include any handouts, and then ultimately it would include a recording and the minutes of today's meeting. And it does have past meetings. So moving on. Okay, an agenda. You have an agenda today. We're following it. An agenda must identify the topics to be discussed with reasonable specificity so that a member of the public can know what is being talked about. No final action can be taken unless a matter is included as an agenda item. Along those lines, what if somebody brings up something that wasn't on the agenda or isn't on the agenda? It's okay to discuss that. You can have a discussion about a particular item if it's important enough. Number one, if the presiding official agrees that it's something significant that should be discussed. However, you cannot take a final action unless it is on an agenda item. So you can discuss a matter, even have some ideas, but then you can postpone it until the next meeting. You can assign it to a committee or request a report or whatever. But you cannot take a final action on a matter unless it is included as an agenda item. All right, next slide. Okay, but what if it's an emergency? A public agency, and the exact quote is, if there are matters of an unforeseen nature, because of unforeseen circumstances, it is necessary to consider matters of an emergency or an urgent nature. You may hold an emergency meeting. And if you've been following the news the last few days, the Salt Lake County Council yesterday had their regularly scheduled meeting, and in that meeting they discussed the mask mandate the county has recently imposed. And they discussed it, and what they've done is they have scheduled an emergency meeting for tomorrow afternoon, and to consider revoking that mask mandate. They actually have it on the public. I'm looking on the public notice website. They have put a notice up for that meeting. Why didn't they vote on it yesterday? Or why couldn't they vote on it yesterday? It's quiz time, but it's because it was not on the agenda. Now, they could discuss it, and they did, and what they, as a type of resolution, what they finally agreed to do was schedule a special meeting, an emergency meeting, for the specific purpose of considering overruling the mask mandate. And so they did follow these steps. Number one, they didn't take action in the regular meeting. They couldn't. They've given the best practical notice. It was part of the minutes of yesterday's meeting, and it has been posted on the public notice website. They've attempted to notify all the members, at least an attempt to notify the county council. I don't know if all the members of the council were there, but they were at the meeting. They voted to conduct this new meeting, and the majority of the members must approve, so that's been done. So that's just an example, a current example of what's going on of an emergency meeting. I would add one word of caution is, if you are to have an emergency meeting, you should limit your actions to the events that arose on the emergency. That's not an excuse to take off and do a bunch of other stuff. There have been examples where there was an emergency, a legitimate emergency, and then they just took advantage of the opportunity and started making a bunch of changes without proper public notice. So an emergency meeting is a possibility, so let's move on to the next slide. Okay, a closed meeting. So what happens in a closed meeting is the public is not allowed to participate. In fact, they would normally leave the room. The only people that would be involved in the meeting are the members of the body, the committee, and any staff members that are necessary. A meeting may be closed only for these reasons that are listed on the screen. To discuss the character, competence, health of an individual, mental or physical health. To discuss a strategy session to discuss the collective bargaining on an employment issue. If there is pending or reasonably pending litigation, we'll be able to discuss the potential responses and strategy. The purchase, lease, or sale of a real property right. In particular, if the value of the property right would be disclosed or if it would impact getting the best possible deal for the purchase or sale of the right. Deployment of security personnel or devices. You don't want to know how the public knowledge where all the cameras are located, for example. If there's necessary for an investigation of misconduct, within the jurisdiction of the committee. Also, I didn't put it on the screen, but it kind of goes along with the purchase of property right, is a response to a solicitation of a bid. That can be, the bids can be opened in a closed meeting. It can be discussed which bid to accept. And then finally, protected trade secrets. If we're entering a contract with KFC and as part of the information we need to know their recipe with the 11 herbs and spices, we can have that in a closed meeting where they can discuss that and protect their trade secret. A closed meeting is, first of all, you have to make has to be made by a motion that we will move to close the meeting. The reason for closing the meeting needs to be identified. You just need to say we are discussing we're discussing a personnel issue, for example. You don't need to talk about like, oh, Fred got another DUI. We need to talk about it in a closed meeting. That kind of defeats the purpose. But you need to identify why we're closing the meeting, and it needs to be approved by a 2/3 majority of the committee and board. And finally, no action, no final action may be taken in a closed session. So you may have a discussion about, you know, the character or competence of an individual. You can have the discussion in a closed meeting, but then you have to reconvene in an open meeting, and then any final action would be taken, would be voted on there. Okay, so let's go on to the next screen. Oh, we've got to click all of those. Click those we're all talking about. There they are. Approved by 2/3 majority. Okay, public meetings are recorded and minutes are taken. A recording is an audio recording, or it could also include a video recording of the meeting in its entirety, unedited. Written minutes are kept as kept of the meeting. Again, we are identifying the time, place of the meeting, and the names of the members who are present. The substance of any actions taken, these are for the minutes, would include the substance of any actions taken, a vote on approving a contract, for example, or approving a new policy, and the votes of each member are recorded. So on important votes, there should be a roll call vote or some way of recording so we know who voted and how they voted. Any names of any persons from the public who provide comment and the substance of their comment in the written minutes. And then also any other information that the committee feels is important to be included as part of the meetings. Any written materials, for example, that are provided would be included as part of the meeting record. I mentioned, notice here, a site tour does not need to be recorded. It would be entered in the minutes that if you visited, for example, a specific child care facility as part of an investigation or for whatever reason. We don't have to follow you around with a tape recorder. So it doesn't have to be recorded, but it would be entered in the minutes that you conducted a tour of whatever facility. Any discussion related to that site tour would be done in the regular meeting. So you'd have to avoid talking about any business at a site tour if that ever comes up. A closed meeting is also recorded. However, the minutes of the closed meeting are not a public record. The recording or the minutes are not public records, but they are still recorded. There are two notable exceptions, and one is deployment of security personnel, if that ever comes up. The recording can be turned off at that point. And the other exception is if you're discussing the character, competence, or health of an individual. And again, you would turn the recording off. You would note it in the minutes that because we are discussing personal information or competence or health of an individual, we are going to turn the minutes off. The presiding officer needs to basically issue a statement that that's why the recording was turned off. And, of course, it has to be promptly turned back on for any other business. We mentioned the beginning earlier, approving the minutes of the last meeting. And, of course, I'm sure most of you have been through that process, but the minutes are approved at the next meeting. The recording, however, is made available almost immediately. In fact, the law requires a recording be posted within 3 days. The minutes, because they take a little bit longer to prepare, they can wait until the next meeting. And the recording and the minutes are, of course, public records except for the closed meetings.
Elliot,
hearing an echo. Yes.
That's my problem. That was my bad. We have a question. It looks like Anna Thomas has her hand raised.
Okay.
Surprise. I have a question. Elliot, thank you for this. Could you repeat what you said earlier a couple slides ago? I'm trying to process it about text messages between people.
This is actually, if you could hold on to that until a couple more slides. Is that all right?
You got it. I will hold on to that.
All right, so let's move on to, minutes. Are there any other questions about minutes or emergency meetings, anything like that? Yeah, let's go on to the next slide. Hey, you are no doubt aware that we can conduct electronic meetings. And this is if the public body, before approving electronic meetings, they pass a rule or a resolution that we conduct electronic meetings electronically, and you identify an anchor location, which I believe is the Metro. It's on the corner of 7th South and 30th?
Second East,
yeah. So that's where Rebecca in Montana, that's where you guys are now.
Correct.
The anchor location is, first of all, members of the body. Maybe the committee could go there for the meeting, but also members of the public could also participate at the anchor location. An electronic meeting is still recorded, and the minutes taken just like any other meeting. So it's actually a really great great thing having electronic meetings, not just as we've been facing and dealing with the pandemic over the last couple of forevers, as it seems like. Utah's a very big state. And so we can actually have people participating throughout the state and do it electronically. a public agency that I worked with. We had a, there was a board that oversaw it, and we had a, one of the members of the board was from Ogden. And even though Ogden's not that far away, between her job and then she had some minor health issues, it was just much more convenient for her to participate electronically. And so she was able to fully participate in the meetings and not impose too much of a burden on her. So that's, anyway, so the electronic meetings, and obviously we're participating electronically right now. Okay, so next slide. Okay, so what happens if we don't follow the Act? What happens if we do something wrong and we screw up? Well, number one, okay, I'll do the button. Any of the actions taken may be voided. So you can go to court and say, hey, they didn't follow the action, the Public Meetings Act, and the court can void the action. I mentioned earlier about the Salt Lake County Council. What if they took a vote and overrode the mask mandate? Well, that would be a violation of the Act. And so they could actually go to a judge and say, hey, the county council didn't put this on the agenda and didn't provide the notice, but they took a final action. And so the court could overrule or override or void that action. And also, individuals may sue to compel compliance. So if there's a member of the public that was not given an opportunity to participate, if, you know, in violation of the Act, they could go to court and say, hey, I wasn't given the chance to, you know, I wasn't given my rights under this Act. So well, what's an obvious problem? Does anybody know how, if you're aware of how long it takes to get to into a courtroom, what would happen is the obvious remedy is have another meeting and do the notice and everything proper. And there's actually a Supreme Court case where they pointed that out. It says you can fix the problem with any problems of the Act by having another meeting and making sure you follow all the steps. So, okay, one more button click. If there is a closed meeting that was not closed properly or was closed for a reason not stated in the Act, has only those reasons I stated. the recording and the minutes from the closed meeting may be made public. And what the process is, the judge would review the information or listen to the recording and then decide if the information should be disclosed with, I think with an understanding of the, one of the main reasons you'd have a closed meeting is you're discussing the competence or the health of an individual, and so that's information is sensitive and should be kept closed, even if the meeting itself, even if the procedure wasn't followed. And by the way, meetings are recorded. You should be careful about what you say, even if it is a closed meeting. So, also, if there's violation of the Act, attorney's fees and court fees may be awarded. So it would cost the state money. And finally, one last thing, let's click. Any member of a public body, any member of this committee that intentionally or knowingly violates the Act, or the exact words, advises a violation of the Act, can be guilty of a Class B misdemeanor, which is a maximum of 6 months in jail and a maximum of $2,500. So just follow the Act. It's not that, it really isn't that difficult, the requirements. Okay, one last thing. We'll talk about text messaging. Conducting meetings. The purpose of meetings, and we have different public agencies, is to maintain order and control and so that we can get the business done efficiently. Follow the agenda. That's what it's for. And focus on the agenda. It is human nature that we'll start talking about stuff and all of a sudden go off on a million different tangents. So really stay focused on the discussion. Let the public comment. Even if you disagree, if you think, if you've been following the news, Anthony Fauci was in a meeting and he let it slip. He said, what a bunch of morons. let the public comment. Even if you disagree and even if you're ready to scream, just let them have their say. Keep track of the motions, any of the motions and votes. Also, it helps to explain what you're doing. Take a minute, and if you're going to have a closed session, for example, just say, we're having a closed session. This is because we're talking about sensitive information, and we feel that this should be done privately and not with the public. I've heard all sorts of stories. People, the members of the public, are just screaming that they're doing something wrong, they're doing something wrong, and he didn't. Because the public didn't understand what was going on. So it does help a lot to explain. Disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. It is in the act specifically that if a person is disrupting the business of the meeting, they may be asked to, you can ask them to be removed. Finally, one last thing. This is what I like to say is be the grown up. You've been entrusted with the, authority or the power to advise Office of Child Care. There's important business that needs to be discussed. And take that responsibility. If there is public comments and they get a little carried away and start making personal attacks, they're not mad at you. They're mad at whatever policy or whatever is being done. You mentioned earlier about texting. This was a story. I was not at the meeting, but it was whatever board, they're having a meeting, and it was during the March basketball tournament, the NCAA basketball tournament. And so a couple members of the committee were texting the scores to each other. They were following the game, and they were, you know. Anyway, someone saw what was going on. And, of course, some of the public didn't realize they were just sending basketball scores to each other. So the public immediately assumed there was something wrong. So one of my professors in law school used to say, don't hand someone the stick that they'll use to beat you with. So avoid things that are making it look like there's something wrong. You mentioned about text messages. Of course you can send text messages to each other. You want to avoid doing that as far as a discussion of a meeting, within the context of a meeting. But just avoid a situation that someone's going to think there's something wrong or there's something up. So, are there any questions on the next slide?
Anna, did that answer your question that you had around text messaging?
Yeah, I guess it strikes me as like odd. And weird. I've never heard that mentioned in the context of Open and Public Meetings Act. I don't know if legislators receive this training as well, or if it pertains to Twitter, but lots of phone usage during meetings for a variety of different strategic reasons, and especially when we're meeting remotely. I mean, I don't quite understand the warning. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just saying... during a meeting, I think you want to avoid anything that people are going to point out and say, oh, hey, something's going on there. You know, they're sending signals to each other or sending text messages or Twitter to each other within the context of the meeting itself. There's nothing wrong with contacting a member of the committee and saying, hey, let's talk about whatever proposal's up. The legislature is a different, that's a whole different kettle of fish. My point is to just avoid doing things that people are going to look at and say, hey, there's something wrong. You know, somebody's doing something suspicious. So obviously you're going to speak with each other, and especially members of an elected body, they're going to be discussing and contacting each other. But just within the when there's an open meeting, in the middle of a meeting is... If there's a comment to be made, make it in public.
Okay, it looks like we have a couple. I think this is actually appropriate because it's about the chat. But we do have a question about if it includes members of the chat, or what about conversations in the chat?
This is a question that comes up a lot. You know, persons, I'm on whatever board or commission, okay? And my neighbor knows I'm on the board, and he comes over and tells me some important information about an upcoming issue. But that person doesn't come to the meeting, and yet he's provided this information. What should I do? Is it, number one, I think you should ask him to come to the meeting, or at the very least provide, you know, provide documentation, especially if it's something, if you feel it's an important piece of information about it. If that doesn't, if failing that, then you could bring it to the meeting saying, hey, my neighbor has informed me about whatever, you know, whatever issue, and then bring that into discussion, and if it's something that needs to be investigated. So I guess the question is, can you talk outside the meeting?
I think the question was more about, in like a virtual meeting, do you have the chat feature? So what about conversations that are happening in the chat feature?
Well, I keep coming back to the same thing, is don't give people a reason to think there's something up. You know, all of a sudden, you know, three quarters of the committee goes into a separate chat room. You know, the public's not allowed. It's the same thing. And even if you were in person, you could still, you know, converse with another member, you know. But again, bear in mind, business of the people needs to be done in public, and that's the whole point of the act is don't do the public's business except in a public meeting. That's the whole purpose of this. Don't hand someone the stick that they used to be. That's the best evidence. There really is no guidance. Obviously, you can talk to each other. Nothing's stopping you from doing that. But are we doing the public's business in a public manner? And even if you speak with the two members of the committee, you can speak to them privately. If it is something you feel is important, then you can discuss it in the open meeting.
Thank you. Any other questions? There's just some more comments in the chat about that you can read. I do say, I mean, outside of public meetings, facilitated meetings, it's hard to run a meeting, and it's also hard to run a separate meeting in the chat. And so I prefer with the board to engage verbally and vocally as part of the meeting, and then we can use the chat as we have places for public comment and be able to get more information. So. Any other questions for Elliot?
This question came up. Do comments and discussions need to be read in the meeting? That's a good question, because they're not recorded. There's no recording of it. Trust your judgment. If you feel that it's something important contributing to the issues of discussion or under discussion, then you probably should at least make a note of it. But a question like this came up, about making comments. Well, we can discuss it. Here we are discussing it in the open meeting. So use your judgment. If it's something like, the Packers are looking pretty good, well, maybe not. Maybe that's something that doesn't need to be discussed. Anyway, use your judgment, and remember that the purpose or the policy of the state is the public's business be done in public. So that's really what it boils down to.
Thank you.
Is there anything else? Any questions?
Questions? Great.
Comments? Concerns?
Thank you.
Compliments?
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm going to move back to the first agenda item. When we started the meeting, and the agenda item for the approval of the November 10th, 2021 meeting minutes, we did not have a quorum, but Montana tells me we have a quorum now, so I would like to take a motion to adopt the November 10th, 2021 meeting minutes.
I would make that motion.
Okay. Any discussion to the motion? Or do we need a second? I'm sorry. Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, so Johnny made the motion. Jody Zabriskie seconded it. Any discussion? All right. We'll go ahead and hold a vote. Those that vote to accept the meeting minutes, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? All right. Votes unanimous. Thank you, Montana. All right. The next agenda item, now going back to agenda item number 3, I do have an update that I wanted to share with you. Just a couple of quick update items. The first, the Office of Child Care has been growing. We have hired 3 new staff, and I just wanted to introduce you. I believe one of our new staff is here today and on camera, Jennifer Floyd, if you want to raise or wave to the group. Jennifer started this week. She will be working as a developmental screening program specialist. This is to be over the project that was generated from the Governor's Early Childhood Commission to grow the ability to collect and data around developmental screenings. We have Colin Krebs, who is going to be joining our team next week. He's going to be a CCQS and an after-school/contracts program specialist, working with Joellen's team. And then we have Jeff Sorensen, who has been hired as a senior business analyst that will help us with our work on the Care About Child Care website and all the other technology platforms that we have in our division. So those are our newest staff, and we're continuing to grow. Hopefully we'll be all fully staffed and don't have any more vacancies to fill. The next item I want to talk about, I just want to do a follow-up on the attendance tracking system, just to provide a little bit of background. A couple of meetings ago last year, talked about an attendance tracking system that we have contracted with to develop for our office. This was in response to an internal audit that was completed in 2018 and 2019. One of the audit recommendations, there were some findings about the reliability of attendance records with providers. And so we were asked to look at solutions and strategies to help increase the reliability of attendance records for children and families that are receiving a child care subsidy. So we contracted, released an RFP to develop an attendance tracking system that would be required, mandatory for all providers at a certain time. We did award a contract in March of 2021. And what the question was asked about the amount of that contract, so I did want to share that with you today. The original contract was for $1,299,000. There has been an amendment to add some enhancements that we desired, and so our contracted costs at this time are $1,360,773. So just over $1.3 million for that contract. In addition to that, I did just want to provide you guys with an update, with an additional update. We heard the feedback that was provided from this board and from others. And so this attendance tracking system is being developed, but it will not be fully implemented and required until July of 2023. Right now, our subsidies are currently being paid based on enrollment, and so we will use this time period to slowly implement and bring providers on board to use this attendance tracking system, and it won't be mandatory until after that policy about paying for subsidy based on enrollment ends. And so one of the things that I've asked our team to do, and we're going to be sending out shortly, is a survey to providers. We want to gather more information that will help inform us on how to best roll out this implementation. Some of the questions we'll be asking, we want to gauge and know from providers how many have their own attendance tracking system. What are some of the features that are included in the systems that they're currently using? We want to know if individuals or providers own their own software, if it's a subscription that they pay a monthly fee for. We are going to be asking if anyone is interested in piloting our attendance tracking system and being an early implementer. And then if there's what hardware would be needed to be able to fully implement. So gathering some more questions so that we can better develop our implementation plan. Anna, you have your hand raised. Do you have a question?
No, I have a comment.
Okay.
Since this is a public meeting and it is on the record, I just want to clarify. So the Office of Child Care is going to spend $1.3 million to implement an attendance tracking system to satisfy the recommendations of the audit, though this issue, I'm guessing, could be entirely avoided by just paying subsidies based on enrollment, as is the practice for private pay child care clients.
We would still, not entirely. We still have to, but part of our CCF guidelines does require that we have checks and balances in place, and that we ensure that our policies are carried out. So even if we're paying for subsidies based on enrollment, there still has to be a need for that. We'll still be asking for attendance records, although the subsidy would be based on the enrollment instead of the attendance.
What would be the benefit of tracking the attendance of kids if it wasn't pertinent for the government subsidy?
Mm-hmm. I think to establish the need also and about child care, and if enrollment, if it's open forever, I think by being able to track attendance each month, we can see if there's someone's been enrolled for 10 months but they haven't actually attended, that would dictate that there may not be the need for the child care subsidy.
Okay. I know that the impact or the, I don't know, whatever, the impact of this commission is extremely limited when it comes to policy. It's been mentioned to us several times over the past several years. But I do believe one of the key functions and statute of this committee is to advise the office on its budget. And I just want to be on the record as saying I think this is not a good use of money, of the government's money. And I think, I don't think providers would feel comfortable saying this because of their relationships with the Office of Child Care, but I've certainly heard from people who are extremely discouraged by the idea of having one more thing to track when it doesn't seem like it's specifically necessary for them to do their jobs and to serve kids on subsidies. So that doesn't require an answer, Rebecca. I don't want to put you on the spot. But I think it's a real problem. I think there are a lot of objections out there in the sector. I don't know that it serves kids and families in any respect. And so appreciate the update, but I think the reality is this isn't something that many people feel excited about, regardless of how the rollout is handled.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Anna. Any other questions or comments? Johnny?
Yeah, I've got a question or comment for Rebecca. I wasn't at the meeting when this was first discussed. If a program already has, a system for tracking attendance, a computer-based system or something where, parents have to clock in and clock out, and so there are, records that we're able to easily provide in the event of a DWS audit based on our existing computer system, would we also have to track on this system as well, or is the system, the electronic system that we have, going to be sufficient?
Yeah, we're looking at having our system be mandatory, but we have received that feedback, and we've been looking at some of the policies other states have where it could be maybe not – what becomes mandatory is a tracking system, and then there's some options if you have your own. We are looking at that and exploring that, but the initial intent was to have our system be the mandatory system for track – or attendance tracking.
Okay, my comment there would be, you know, I would encourage you to look at it, you know, certainly check with attorneys and auditors, and if a provider already has a system in place, I mean, we're not going to dump our system to use yours because we use it for so many things, for food program tracking and payments and communicating with parents and lots of stuff. So it definitely would be a double requirement. We would have to have parents, and I'm assuming we're just talking about subsidy. We would have subsidy parents clocking in twice, and that would, I mean, not only be annoying, but it would be an identifier of who our subsidy clients are. I mean, not that anybody's paying close attention to that, I would hope, but I know that's something that we're supposed to try to keep confidential. So just to comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I also will make a comment that if in fact that this is going to proceed, that you get feedback from the people that are actually going to be using it so that we can give that honest feedback and possibly helpful feedback so that we don't have a situation where you're spending so much on software because software is extremely expensive to develop. But not only that, but just ongoing. And so it's there's some things that we know being down in the trenches that you possibly don't know that's going to be a big waster of money. And then I'd like to second with Anna too. Just it's pretty difficult to be okay with this software when hopefully it's not really needed.
Great. Thank you. All right. The next
one.
Oh, sorry.
Rebecca, can we just clarify with me? I do remember talking about this, having this discussion before, right? So this isn't new.
Correct.
You knew how it felt. Okay. And then I also just wanted to make sure that this was already awarded and the money has already been paid, right?
Yes.
Right. And who was it awarded to? Who's got the contract?
It is City. It has the contract.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. The next item on my update was a membership update. We are still seeking membership and representatives to fill two vacancies. One is to represent the corporate community, and the other parent representing households that are receiving a child care subsidy. So, again, if you have people that are interested, please share with your networks. That we have these two vacancies available. They can reach out to me or to Montana submit their interest for this board. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that we have we need to update our conflict of interest for the board members. So Montana will be sending out a conflict of interest form to the board members, and we ask that you get that signed and returned back to her quickly. The next item that I want to talk about was with an administrative rule update. We have been working and receiving feedback from our advocate community over the last year about a definition that in our the definition of work in our subsidy program, and having that definition in place. A portion of the definition states that wages have to be obtained legally to meet the employment definition. And so that does create some problems for individuals that are in mixed status families where they have citizen children and then citizen children with parents that are not citizens or not documented. The feedback and the request has been to look at that employment definition. There was an administrative rule that was posted and made available for public comment in the month of December that would remove that statement of wages obtained legally out of our employment definition. The public comment period ended last week, and we have received comments. We're looking through them. We're working with our legal office and also getting final approvals to make that change as outlined in the proposed administrative rule. We do have a period of time where we that we need to make that change. There's some policy changes that would have to go into effect. We have to do some technology changes, which takes a little bit of time, and training our staff. And so we are working within our office and in our department on what that time frame would look like, and I don't have an exact time frame for you today. But we are looking and making preparations for when we get that final approval to be able to move forward with that. This one of the things that will require, and kind of leads into the next item, is that we would have to amend our state plan. So that employment definition is something that was included in our CCDF state plan, and so that is a substantial change that would have to, in addition to the work that we do internally with our policies, we would also have to amend our state plan. Any questions or comments about that update? All right. With that state plan, I did want to share with you one of the things that we committed to during that plan process is to communicate more about the state plan. I want to let you know that we received a conditional approval for our plan that was submitted last July. Some of the conditions that were included in that, many of the states had asked for a waiver for the section that talks about how they determine their subsidy rates. We didn't ask for that waiver, but there was enough states that asked for the waiver that the federal office is going to withhold any compliance decisions on that piece of the plan until those waivers expire in July of this year. Also, with the federal office was aware of our public comment for the administrative rule that I just talked about with our employment definition, and so they have not made a compliance determination based on that component of our plan. Just they were pending what would happen with the proposed administrative rule changes. So our plan is approved. It's a plan, and we will start amending it with some of these changes immediately. Any questions about the state plan? Last on the update, and this was not included on the plan, but Elliot, I think I'm okay because I'm not going to ask for a vote. This wasn't on the agenda. I did want to just follow up. Last month I told you about some of the legislative discussions that had happened during the intern meeting, and I had mentioned that Representative Pulsifer has a bill about child care amendments. I just want to let you know that that bill has been numbered, and so I think it might be of interest for this board and for members of the public to follow. It's House Bill 15, Child Care Amendments. So the legislative session does start next week, and we'll be following all things related to our office and then just child care in general. So I wanted to give you that update. Any questions about Agenda Item 3? Elizabeth.
Rebecca, question for you. Thanks for following all of those. Obviously, there's some of us on this call that will be following them closely as well. But I'm curious to know, as things move through the session, how you guys will be then advocating for or against things and how it impacts childcare. And what that looks like, because I think that it's important for, as you know, the Office of Child Care for you to be supporting things that are good for kids and good for child care.
Providers. I do think it's a little bit weird and awkward. I think some of you understand that. We are part of the administrative branch. We are neutral in bills, and we are neutral in the process, but we are available and to answer questions, to provide with our expertise. People ask us questions, and we create fiscal notes, and so we respond back, but we really do remain neutral during the legislative process.
Well, I get being neutral to a certain extent, but
as experts, there's also a certain component of also seems like advocating what's best for children and providers within this, because that's something that's not really neutral.
Yeah.
And so where does that line come for you in that?
I would work with, we have a legislative liaison in our office with Kevin Burt, who's our one of our deputy directors. We would work with him to engage in that, to engage in those conversations.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right. Our last meeting, we had talked about wanting to do a brainstorming activity or a working group meeting to talk about some of our COVID relief funding. I had indicated that we have some of our COVID relief funding that has not been, obligated or identified. And rather than just opening it up to a discussion, in fact, Montana, can I actually have you... Will you scroll forward on the slide and go two forward? I'm going to switch up one of the agenda items, if that's okay. Go one more forward. Just I wanted to show you, this is our budget update. One of the things that we talked about, and the question we had last time is, what were some of the prioritized supports or initiatives that we wanted to do with some of our COVID relief funding? If you recall, last spring and summer, late spring, we met with members of the advocate community, members of our community partners, and really discussed and brainstormed what are the best uses of some of our COVID relief funding. What are some of the gaps that we've identified during COVID-19 and how to address that? We had asked, or I can't remember, in the discussion we'd asked, well, what were the things that we prioritized and how did we address them? And so this screenshot here shows you these were the list of items, the prioritized supports that were that we rated a high need and we wanted to address first. And then I've indicated the programs that we've implemented, which we have talked about in our previous meetings, and then the funding and the funding source attached. Under the additional prioritized items, there are a few that we have not addressed yet. And rather than rehashing and kind of opening that up, I wanted to do a more targeted support. So, Montana, if you go back to the previous slide. I'd like to spend just the next 20 minutes or so to do a quick brainstorming activity. And I want to ask questions really around how can we help increase the supply capacity for infant toddler care. We released the Child Care Access Report March of 2020 and identified that infant and toddler care is the highest need. It has the lowest vacancy. Again, this is all pre-pandemic, and so things may have changed drastically, but my gut tells me that there is still a great need for increasing the supply of infant care within our system. And so what I'd like to do is we're going to break everyone out into a breakout session. And I'd like you to appoint a person to be in charge and facilitate. And I'd like you to walk through and ask these questions and talk about these questions. You may not be able to get to all of them, but I'd like the group to talk about what are some of the barriers that exist in our infant toddler capacity right now? What are supports that are needed to be able to increase the infant toddler supply? And then kind of a sub-question of that, are the supports different for in a center environment versus a family in home provider type? And then finally, how should ARPA discretionary funding be used to increase? We may not be able to do all of the strategies that you guys propose, but what would be the best use of the ARPA discretionary funding? ARPA discretionary funding, just to remind you, it does not require that it is linked to a COVID-19 response. It's a little more open in how the funds can be used, but it does have to follow the uses of our the Child Care Development Fund. And so looking at subsidy, looking at quality initiatives, increasing quality for low-income families. What I'd like to do is break you out into these groups, and we'll spend 10 minutes talk through some of these, and then we'll come back and we'll do a quick report out. Our time is not very long, and we have some other agenda items, so if we need to push some things, we will do that. But I do think it's important to get the feedback and to have this group, and also we'll be involving members of the public. And so it will be the board members and those in the public that are participating to help us identify how to focus our efforts around the infant and toddler capacity within our system. Any questions about what we're going to do for the next few minutes? All right.
Rebecca, just to confirm, you want us to break out into these sessions and somebody to take notes, and in case we don't get to those notes, but then just send the notes to you?
Yes, that's a great idea. Thank you, Megan. If you'll capture the notes and then send them back to us, and then our office will review them and develop a plan going forward. Any other questions? Thanks, Megan. All right. Montana's going to break us out into breakout rooms. If you get lost, you can click on a button to come back to the main room, and we will reroute you and cross our fingers that this works smoothly. She's working some magic here. I'll tell you, you guys don't get the benefit of seeing. She's creating.
Rebecca, are we putting the questions in the chat as well? Just to let people know.
Yes. I will do that. While Montana works out of the breakout rooms, I'll put these questions in the chat.
Rebecca, you're muted.
Oh. I'm muted. There you go. All right, sorry. I will put the questions in the chat, and then Montana will get you all in the room.
It was not enough time.
It was not enough time. I heard someone say that. I agree.
That was me. Sorry.
Okay.
It's all right. We all live and die by the clock.
All right, you guys, I'm sorry that wasn't enough time. To be honest, it was a gamble. I wasn't sure that we'd be able to break out and come back. And so we'll have more conversations, but I do just want to, each group, I'd ask your note taker, do you guys hear some feedback? I'll try to fix that. Sure, I'm muted. All right, we'll try to work on that. I will ask the note takers to please send me your notes so that we can capture them. Are you muted? I'm muted. Is that working? Can you still hear me without feedback? Thank you. Okay. I'll ask the note takers to send me the notes, and then my team will review them. But I do just kind of debrief. Does anyone have, like, the best idea they've ever heard, and it's new and innovative, that they want to share with the group? Does anyone have a really great idea that maybe we've heard, and maybe not as innovative, that they want to share with the group?
Someone asked the childcare provider, if they were to throw money at it, would I still double half the capacity that I have in my infant toddler program? And I didn't buy it right away. And she actually threw a big number at me. So I don't know what that would take. I realize that you're asking how to spend money, but I'm not sure money is that exact right answer at this moment.
Yeah. You're right. You know, everything is a big constraint. So what... Is there an opportunity to address that constraint within our system with the funding we have now? You're right, Jamie. Well, sorry, Johnny, go ahead.
Rebecca, so Jody and I were on the same group, and we were able to kind of, you know, kick around what it would cost. Let's say you have a center, you don't currently offer infant care. For some reason, out of the goodness of your heart, you'd love to be able to offer that infant care, but your facility is not set up for it right now. There are specific plumbing requirements you have to have for infant care. You do need to have, you know, cribs are quite expensive. Stacking cribs, a set of, two stacking cribs, so an upper and a lower, are about $1,800 delivered now. So, you know, you need probably four of those if you're going to have a room for four. So we talked about, okay, stacking cribs, adding the additional sink that's required, plus you would most likely have to update your playground because there are restrictions on infant toddler play equipment, and you cannot have infants and infants out on the playground with other children unless you have your their own fenced-off area. So realistically, you're probably talking between $20,000 and $25,000 just to make those physical facility changes that would be needed to add a classroom of four infants. So that's, I mean, that's something. If I don't know if there are providers out there who are like, boy, you know, I'd really love to offer this service. I just can't afford that upfront cost. You know, this kind of money can be used for that. I don't know what it can do to help, you know, with the ongoing loss of revenue that you have in offering infant care, but at least it could help with the upfront cost.
Thank you. Thanks for that group. Julie, you had your hand raised. Did you have a comment? Maybe not. Holly, do you have a...
No, sorry. I was thinking to see if I was on mute. No, I did that on accident. I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. Holly, is your hand raised on purpose?
Yes, it is.
Okay, good.
Some of the things that I wanted to bring out, I do feel like that it's different for family child care than it is for centers. We do have a little more lax rules as far as infant care for family child care providers. I know that we had quite a few providers that were a little bit upset about some of the licensing rules regarding infant care. I don't know that we would really go that route too much just because I feel like that those rules were all there for a good reason. But my suggestion was I wondered if we could have some infant specific grants or ways that you could have maybe a supply library to help cover the cost of some of those infant materials that you need that are just, you really only need them for about 6 months, 4 to 6 months as the infants are growing, so that we could have some kind of a library, like a lending library, to check out a high chair or some of the infant toy, some of the infant toy things that are really, really hard for a family child care to purchase, but you really only need them for a couple months, and then so that we could just offer supplies like those to providers as needed and be able to kind of have a community share program, something like that. And maybe possibly if there's providers, I know that licensing just updated their rule in the last 6 months to where you could have more infants if you had more providers. So if it's family child care wanted to specialize in interest in infants, then if they could have maybe a special grant or something they could do to purchase infant supplies to help them with the cost on that.
Great. Thank you. That is our time. So I apologize for that. We will get the information back and we can send that back out to the board so they can see the good that came, and we'll report back next time we meet on the information that was gathered and some strategies that we think would be that we could implement with this funding. All right, we have I'm going to turn the time over. I had shared my budget update is introducing this activity. So each time we meet, we have one of our Care About Child Care agencies that are reporting on some of the local efforts that they have put in place with the COVID relief funding that they received. And so we have Carolyn Ellsworth that is here from Children's Service Society that will highlight what they have been working on.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're good. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, good afternoon. I'm Carolyn Ellsworth, the program director for Care About Child Care at Children's Service Society. And can you go to the next slide? And I'm going to briefly talk to you about what we're doing with our CRSA Act funding. My SDA covers the metro area, which is Salt Lake and Tooele counties. Next slide. And we were tasked with creating a proposal two springs ago. I don't know. The COVID timeline, I don't know what year it is and how long it's been, but it was a while ago. And we were tasked to create a proposal that addresses child care sustainability. And all of the child care about child care kind of came up with their own ideas of what child care sustainability looks like. And so these are our goals that we were looking at. To increase the quality of programming and provide tools for which programs can be more sustainable into the future in order to deliver a healthy workforce that supports and provides care for the most vulnerable in our community, our children. So we're focusing on already existing child care and family child care businesses to help them sustain their business practices over time. Some of the other SDAs are focusing on how to build childcare, new programs in their areas, and so we chose to focus on already up and running programs. Next slide. So these are the types of programs that we have in our SDA. This was as of May of 2021, so these numbers may have changed in the last 6 months, but this was the data that we used when we wrote our proposal. Next slide. How we determined the need, we used the Child Care Access in Utah report in 2020. This was the report that Rebecca mentioned earlier. And we also surveyed program owners and directors and assistant directors and asked four different questions. We sent out an email request and a survey to all the programs in our SDA, and we got 83 responses back. Next slide. The questions that we asked in our initial email were these four questions. What does your business need immediately? What does your business need in the next year? What does your business need in the next 5 years? And if provided with a free consultant or coach, what areas would you would most likely like assistance with? Yeah. I was going to share all of the data with you, but in the essence of time, I didn't do that. So let's go to the next slide. I can give you some more specifics at the end if you'd like about how people responded. But how we came up with our categories is we sent out a second survey to those that responded. And after we analyzed our data, we came up with these three key elements. Programs are interested in providing high-quality care, which is connected to the CCQS. Coaching and help with staff recruitment and retention, and then also business operations. So those are our three key elements that we'll focus on for this funding. Next slide. So the plan is a two-year project with 2 one-year cohorts. The cohorts consist of 10 centers and 10 family child care programs for each year for a total of 40 participating programs. Let me see the next slide. I'm not sure what information I have on there. Actually, I could just look over here at my other screen. we had them fill out information and used a scoring rubric, and our rubric took into consideration the heat map zip codes that were found in the child care thing that was done in March. There were specific heat maps and zip codes that were particularly focused on programs with high number of subsidy children. So if their program was in certain zip codes, they received 3 points or 2 points or 1 point, just depends on where they were at. We were also asking about the number of DWS children they have, what their enrollment capacity was at that current time. Were they full, half capacity, below than half, and just some kind of open-ended questions. And based on the rubric is how we chose our first 20 programs that we are working with. So these are the categories that we're working with. Next slide, please. And there's, I just explained all that. So coaches will spend an hour a week on a location with each program. Coaches and the coordinator meet weekly to discuss further how to support programs. And then participating programs will be required to participate in mandatory training specific to their goals. So at this point, we've been implementing this since October. We've had some difficulty hiring coaches, so I've been taking on part of that role as being a coach, as well as our coordinator, Danielle. And we recently just hired a full-time coach who started yesterday, which is fantastic. So we've kind of been piecing it together as we go along, but the programs that I've been working with have some really great goals as far as meeting their CCQS quality requirements and retaining and requiring quality staff. So next slide. So by focusing on these three objectives, we were able to hone in on what providers have reported as critical issues. Each objective is an umbrella for other important factors. So providing high quality care requires that providers are trained and especially using research-based curricula. So we're utilizing Career Ladder and some other options that are out there. Training is selected to focus on a lot of the topics that include enriching environments, CCQS, family engagement, mental health. It's interesting that as we're out in the community, we're finding out that the mental health in young children and professionals is becoming a number one goal for a lot of the programs that we're working with. So we have a great partnership with the Children's Center and have been able to make some referrals to them, which has been great. And next slide. The staff recruitment and retention addresses staff morale and camaraderie, team building, and evaluating non-monetary reasons why people stay in the workforce. We would love to throw money at the problem, but that's difficult to do sometimes. So if we can bring up staff morale and be able to help with programs to recognize great work is important. And then the business operations portion is if programs are interested in, you know, getting an accounting software or a login software or any kind of things like that. We've had some interest in people wanting to get ProCare and things like that. So that's what the business operations part is about. And I think that's my last slide. Are there any questions? All right. Well, if you have any questions, you can always email me at carolyn@css.utah.org, and I'll be happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Carolyn. It's been really interesting to hear the different approaches each area has taken and implemented, and so I appreciate this feedback or this presentation, and
appreciate the work that you and your team are doing in supporting these 40 providers over the next couple of years. So thank you. All right.
Thank you.
The next several agenda items are updates from our program managers and our staff. So we will be quickly, we'll go through these quickly. And actually, before we, Holly, do you have a question?
I just had a question real quick for Carolyn. Okay. I'm still getting quite a few reports that providers, family child care providers, are trying, as they're trying to navigate their Care About Child Care page, they're having a hard time getting to that, and they still can't get a hold of people at the Care About Child Care office to answer their questions. Do you know if they are, like, is there someone available to answer the phones now? How is that looking?
Well, I know from, I'm the director of my program, and I have the phone right here in my home office, and it rings and gets answered, so I can't speak for other SDAs. I know that the folks that I've been working with in this stabilization project, I've been giving them direct emails and phone numbers for them to contact on getting through this website, you know, problem. So I can't speak for other SDAs, but I think our office does a pretty good job of helping people out. Again, they can contact me. I am the big cheese in my office, and I can get them to the people that they need and certainly help them out if they need. I'll put my email in the chat.
Thank you. That would be nice. Maybe we might just have the wrong number. I'm betting by now we just have the wrong numbers listed. But, yeah, if we could get some contact information that I could pass along. I know that there was one Care About Child Care agency that seems to help anyone I send their way. I think it's the one in Logan. But, yeah, thank you. I appreciate your help.
Thank you for the feedback and the question.
Thank you. All right, we'll start with our team update. So we'll go quickly through the reports that they're providing are on the slideshow, but also for the members of the general public that didn't get this emailed out, you can access that off the public notice website. But we have Kathy Randall, who will give us an update on our stabilization grant.
Hello, everybody. The information is as of Monday, so we've received, and I just wanted a quick update today. We've received 550 applications for the stabilization grant. We've approved 193 applications. We're in the process of working on about 274, so about half of the applications we've either processed or we're in the middle of processing. We issued our first payment last week, and notifications were mailed out. And then we issued our second round of payments today. They were mailed out today. So if you received a letter stating that you were approved and prior to last Wednesday and you have not received a payment or a check, please contact us at the OCC stabilization at utah.gov. And because those payments were mailed to the mailing address listed through your Care About Child Care account. So if that mailing address was not accurate, then that's where the checks were sent. So our first monthly reports will be due at the end of February. And the required documentation is the payroll documentation for all of the individuals associated with your program and child care licensing. So that's a quick update. I'm sure there's a lot of questions. So if you have specific questions, please email us, and we will get back to you as soon as possible.
Looks like we do have one question. Elizabeth?
Yeah, question. So for the applications that haven't been approved yet, will you then backdate them to when you receive them so that they'll receive payments for the months that they've been waiting for that?
For the ones received, so there were not any payments issued in December. So are you talking about the ones in January that we've received, if they will receive a January payment?
Any applications that haven't been approved yet where it's you've received them but they haven't been approved yet and gone through the process, like will you be backdating those funds?
Yeah, so Elizabeth, one thing that's different about this application, it kind of works like our other benefit applications that people can apply at any time, and so they won't necessarily, depending on when they apply, they'll get payments for the months that they applied, but we won't, like if they don't apply until February, they don't apply until later, they won't go back and get previous month's payments. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. But if someone applied in December... but they're not, haven't been approved yet. Will they, have all of those backlogs been approved now?
No, the applications that have applied in December, we're still working through those. And so, yes, we will go and do payments were first available in January. So we will make sure that gets connected.
Okay.
Get that.
Great.
Holly.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, me again. I had a question on when they issue the check. So I know when you very first submit your application, so all of us who just, like, if I got my application approval letter on Monday, then I'm guessing that I can expect the check to be cut for me on Wednesday. Is that right?
Yeah, the check should have been mailed today.
Great. And so then from here on out, so like February, March, April, May, do I get a check at the beginning of the month, or will it always be the second week of the month?
It will be the beginning of the month.
Okay. So I'll get my first check maybe at the end of this week, and then for February, I'll get my check at the beginning of the month. Sorry.
Yeah, it will be the first Wednesday of the month that those will be.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
All right. Our next update is Joellen. She has our CCQS update. Oh, Joellen, you're muted. Sorry.
I always forget that. Sorry. So I'm just going to provide some data regarding where we're at. We did open the CCQS application to programs that any program that hadn't already been rated in since September or previously or had been rated but their rating had expired previously. And we have had 14 programs apply. Three of them are programs that had previously had a rating at some point, and they're going to get rated again. 11 are programs that have never applied for a rating before. So, so 14 in the first 10 days of the month is pretty, is the most we've ever gotten when we had it open. So we'll see what the rest of the month brings. Our current rating distribution for centers, though, 65 out of the 371 centers that are currently licensed in the state have a certified rating. So that's 17% of all centers at this moment. The distribution, now this particular piece of data includes those that applied with the temporary framework as well as those that applied with the standard framework. So there's programs that applied overall that aren't on here yet because they haven't received their new rating. But the way it stands right now, 20 out of 65 or 31% have a foundation of quality. 18 out of 65 or 28% have a building. 23 out of 65 or 35% have a high quality. And 4 out of 65 or 6% have a high quality plus. So the high quality plus, previously we only had one program at high quality plus. Two of the building quality programs moved know, two of the high quality programs moved to High Quality Plus, and one that was building quality moved to High Quality Plus. And high quality programs, we have 23. We did have four that were previously high quality that are now at building at this time. And then we had two high quality programs that didn't apply with either of the frameworks. So that kind of counts for our high quality people. So I went through and I looked at it and I aligned some of the data with, we aligned it with the what we report to the Fed, the measurements that we report to the Fed each year on our QPR. So we have received 87 applications so far. So the total number of licensed center programs that have actually applied are 23%. Well, 23% have applied, 17% have been rated. So I need to note that these do not include, we couldn't measure on the temporary framework for all of these, so we didn't use, so all of this data is the 51 programs that have been rated on the standard framework. So we may, so the things that we measure are the ERS observation score increase. So we look at their total score on the framework, not their individual scores, but the total score on the framework. So 28 out of 61 of the programs increased their total observation score from their baseline well, the last time they were rated. So 55% of the programs had an increase. For SAPQA, so for the school age tool, 21 out of 42, or 50%, had an increase. Another thing we look at is an increase in the points for the education as a director. 18 out of 51 programs increased both points, so 35%. We also look at the increase for the education of caregivers. 9 out of 51 programs increased their points in that area, so 18%. We also look at their overall, all the points that they had last time. The last time they were rated, what was their total points on the framework? And we found that 30 out of 51 or 59% have increased their overall points. And let's see, I can't see that. I think the bottom one is, oh, how many of them had an increase in their certified rating? So 10 out of 51, I believe it's 20%. I can't see it, but had increased their the quality rating that they previously had. So they went from either building to high or high to high quality, or in some cases foundation to building, or just somewhere they had an upward movement. So I have complimented the providers in every meeting because as the data comes in, it really does show their diligence. It really does show their dedication to really continuing to strive for quality. And I think that's great for our children in this state. And I think that kudos to the providers. I can never say that enough. So this is what I have currently for centers. Does anybody have any questions about any of this? And then we'll look at family.
Thank you, Joellen. I do. This page. I'm just wondering if, I mean, it just seemed like it was such a challenging year. So to see these is really, like you say, kudos to those providers and wonderful. And I'm wondering if there's any way you can show that the funding that they've received over this past year has actually impacted their ability to increase their quality.
As far as their enhanced subsidy grant?
Like, can you prove that the people that have increased have actually also taken advantage of some of the subsidies that have been provided?
I haven't looked at that. So you mean things like the operations grant and that type of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We haven't looked at that at this point. That would be a really interesting thing to look at, though.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I can certainly talk to our group about. That would be a really interesting thing to look at. But at this point, I don't have any data for that particular thing.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Anything else?
Thank you, Jeannie.
We are still rating and scoring, so we have 10 centers, I believe it's 10 centers that will be scored on the 20th of this month, and we also have some family providers that will be scored on the temporary framework. So, and then we still have observations going on. So I'll update you in the next meeting as to where we're at that time with the same data. So the next slide, thanks, Montana.
Jamie's.
Is family child care data. This is very different because they were rated for the first time with the temporary framework. And so we don't have baseline data to compare like we do with this particular group of centers. So what I have here is just showing the current rating distribution for those that have gotten their rating and how many applications and percentages that we've had for family child care. So for family child care, we have had 52 programs receive a rating. There's 743, or there were at the moment that this was created. Those things can change almost every day. And so 7% of all licensed family child care programs currently have a rating. So you can see the distribution down here. Some of them, even though they were rated, they still came in at default foundational quality because they didn't have the minimum number of points for a certified rating. So 46% came in at a default foundation. Certified foundation, 9 out of 52 or 17.3% are at a certified foundation. And certified building, 19 out of 52 or 36.5% have a certified building quality rating at this time. We will be rating more family child care providers on the 20th, and I'll have more to add to that chart for our next meeting. So the applications received by month, we received a total of 137 applications during the window, which was June 1 to December 31. And the total number, when you look at the percentage, 18.4% of all family child care providers applied with the temporary rating. So you can see the distributions here. We had a really low month in September. Our largest month was the last month, which is December. That's always the case anytime we have any kind of opportunity. The last month that is, or the right around the deadline, we always have the most applications. So that really wasn't a surprise, even though I was surprised how many did come in during that holiday week. That was interesting. So we had a big push in June, and then it was kind of low. We had our Care About Child Cares do a lot of outreach and work. And then, so did our Family Child Care Association. They did a lot to really help providers understand what it is and know what to do. And so that was really helpful too. So, these providers, will be able, just like the centers have the opportunity for those that had been rated, have an opportunity for kind of like an early rating, with a standard framework. This particular group of 137 providers will as well. So in March, we'll open the application for them. Every one of them that is interested, that wants to have a rating and try for an enhanced subsidy grant, will basically put us on notice in March by putting in an application. And then we will figure out the distribution in April, start initial visits in May, and have observations in June. So after we get those applications and we can project our work, we'll be able to know when we can open up the framework to everybody else, just like we did centers. I'm hoping it will be with centers. I was very pleased that we were able to open it 3 months earlier than I projected. I thought April. We were able to open it in January. I hope that that will be the case. We've had a really, really successful relaunch as far as our frontline workers and our reliability with the environment rating skills trainers has gone perfectly this year.
they've been able to get, and our previous observers became reliable very quickly. So far, and I even hate to say it out loud, because whenever I say things out loud, I think we all know how that goes. But so far, it's been overall pretty smooth. COVID throws some monkey wrenches sometimes, and we have to make adjustments, but we do. So that is family child care, if anybody has any questions about that.
Great. Thanks, Joellen. All right. Next we have Megan that's going to give us an update on after-school program and some school readiness updates.
Yeah, I'll be very quick. Just let you know, for out-of-school time, I have met with various partners throughout the fall of 21 to discuss our current grant structure, and also met the grantees with a feedback meeting. And what has become from that is that we are going to be changing our structure of our grants. We will be introducing this probably at the beginning or mid-March for our RFGAs, for our school-age grants, and then in April for our teen programs. I will bring the grant structure to our next advisory meeting once we have actually been able to make it a public space. Next slide. And then school readiness, just a quick update on where we're at for this year. The next school readiness board meeting is March 16th, 1 to 3 p.m. And at our last board meeting, they had approved the release of multi-year grants versus single-year grants for both expanded student access and Becoming Quality. And then I have provided you with the numbers of the students served and the funding that has been doled out to our LEAs and private providers for our school readiness programs. If you have any questions, just shoot me an email.
Thanks, Megan. All right, Heather is going to give us an update on professional development.
Hi, I am giving a brief update on our scholarship data for this meeting. And so this first slide is our Child Care Development Fund, CCDF-funded scholarships. So most of those that we've given out are within the Child Development Associate Credential, either the initial fees or the renewal. And we've awarded since July, the start of our fiscal year, we've awarded 77 related to the CDA, and 12 have been submitted, but we haven't processed those yet, so more to come. And then the other main place where we have been offering scholarships is with the National Administrator's Credential, so that includes the initial fees, a renewal of that credential, or a demonstrated competency observation in order to make that count for our clear letter level 4. And so we've awarded 18 of those so far. You can see we're pretty much in line, kind of in between the number, if you look at half of what, you know, half the year so far, between what we offered or what we gave out, awarded in fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 21 for those scholarships so far. And go to the next slide. This is our CURSA-funded scholarship data from since July. So we released our Quorum e-learning annual training subscription. We have had 606 people sign up for that online training, and that was released in July. And then our other fee, which we announced in the last meeting as opening up in mid-November, we have just started. Thank you to the professional organizations that have worked on letting people know about the conference registration scholarship, because I think that's where a lot of those scholarships have been awarded for some of their conferences that they've hosted, and let people know about that. And then we're just getting started with the college degree payback program and the college courses. We have a few that have been submitted, we haven't processed yet, and then we're working with our communications department and our partnering agencies to get the and the Institutes of Higher Ed to get our the word out about those scholarships and so people can utilize them. So just at the beginning stages of those. That's it. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Heather. All right, we have a couple of agency updates. We'll start first with child care licensing and Simone.
Very quick.
Because of Omicron, some people might be asking if we're changing the approach for childcare licensing. We are not. We won't require face masks for employees or children, but we highly recommend them, and we highly recommend vaccinations as well. If you have special mandates, like the Summit County or Salt Lake County, providers are required to follow those mandates as well. And we have posted new interpretation manuals. They are dated January of 2022. If you have any questions, let us know. Thank you.
Thank you, Simone. All right, USCE, Jared.
Okay, great, thanks. I'll try to make this quick too. Just some updates here. First thing is the USCE preschool workshop. And since I provided this information just the other day, there has been a change with the increasing COVID numbers and the desire for a lot of people at this time to not be in person. We have decided to cancel the Eastern region, which was scheduled for the 28th, and encourage people in the eastern part of the state to register for the virtual conference, which will be on February 11th. The other two, February 18th in Heber City and February 25th at Salt Lake Community College, are still scheduled. Please do encourage your staff to register for those through MIDAS. There's a handout flyer that's in the meeting materials for this meeting that you can go to for that information. We have some good keynotes lined up for February 11th. February 25th, we have First Lady Abby Cox, and I just put my mind to February 11th, but yeah, we have some really good speakers and presenters and keynotes there. The second thing here is the Standards Implementation Institute. This is a professional learning opportunity that's coming up next summer. There's also a flyer attached to the meeting materials for this. It costs $50 per day per person and to attend this, and it's intended and designed to help staff members to implement the early learning standards into their classroom in effective ways. The last update, just really briefly, many of you may be aware, but some may not be aware, that the Preschool Pioneer page on the Utah Education Network site has been updated and changed. It's now a Preschool Path. It's still a resource for families to go to and for teachers to go to for information about preschool and early childhood education. The resources under the Preschool Path site have something that many teachers are not aware of quite yet. It's the strategies and activities documents. Basically, for each of the early learning standards, there's some recommended ideas for how to implement these effectively in classrooms, as well as ideas that parents can use to help guide the learning and instruction for children around the early learning standards. So please do refer your staff to those and go check them out yourselves. That's, in a nutshell, really briefly, the updates that I have. Are there any questions? Oh, and here's the picture of the flyers for the state preschool workshop with the information about how to sign up for those, as well as the standards implementation. Registration is not yet open for the standards implementation coming up this summer, but as you can see, they are going to be held around the state, Ridgefield, June 6th through 9th, Uinta, June 13th through 16th, Green Canyon High School, 20th through 23rd, as well as there's Washington Intermediate School, Bonneville, Springville, and then East High School.
Great. Thank you, Jared. I appreciate our partner agencies presenting and sharing information with us. Is there any other business from the board? All right. I want to make sure we have opportunity for public comment. I know we're over our time a little bit, but I do want to offer up an opportunity for any public comments at this time. All right, not seeing any, I would call for a motion to adjourn our meeting.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Thanks, Johnny. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
A lot of people want to second that. Thanks, Elizabeth. And then, all right, we'll go ahead. I won't even call for a vote. We'll go, and I thank everyone for participating, and we'll be back together March 9th.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.